Joy Cardine with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, 9 minutes past 8 o'clock now on this Monday, January the 29th. And I'll bet we'll have a lively hour this hour as we talk to Dinesh D'Souza, author of The Enemy at Home, The Cultural Left and Its Responsibility for 9/11. That's right. The Cultural Left and Its Responsibility for 9/11. Let me share with you this from the introduction of Mr. D'Souza's book. In this book, I make a claim that will seem startling at the outset. The cultural left in this country is responsible for causing 9/11. The term cultural left does not refer to the Democratic Party, nor does it refer to all liberals. It refers to the left wing of the Democratic Party, admittedly the most energetic group among Democrats and the main source of the party's ideas. The cultural left also includes a few Republicans, notably those who adopt a left-wing stance on foreign policy and social issues. Some leading figures in this group are Hillary Clinton, Ted Kennedy, Nancy Pelosi, Barbara Boxer, George Soros, Michael Moore, Bill Moyers, and Noam Chomsky. Moreover, the cultural left includes organizations such as the American Civil Liberties Union, the National Organization for Women, People for the American Way, Planned Parenthood, Human Rights Watch, and MoveOn.org. In faulting the cultural left, I am not making the absurd accusation that this group blew up the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. I am saying that the cultural left and its allies in Congress, the media, Hollywood, the nonprofit sector, and universities are the primary cause of the volcano of anger toward America that is erupting from the Islamic world. The Muslims who carried out the 9/11 attacks were the product of this visceral rage, some of it based on legitimate concerns, some of it based on wrongful prejudice, but all of it fueled and encouraged by the cultural left. Thus, without the cultural left, 9/11 would not have happened. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. 263-1890. That's the number to call if you're in Madison. Or send us an email to talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. We welcome your participation in our discussion during this hour. And as I mentioned at the top of the hour, I would appreciate your participation and not an email or a telephone call at the end of the hour saying, "Why didn't you ask this?" You ask it. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I am happy to welcome Dinesh D'Souza to Wisconsin Public Radio. He will be in Wisconsin tomorrow, by the way, taking part in the UW-Madison Distinguished Lectures Series, and I'll give you more information on that that event a little bit later in the program. Dinesh D'Souza is the Robert and Karen Rishwain Fellow at the Hoover Institution for Stanford University. He has been called one of the top young public policymakers in the country by Investor's Business Daily. The New York Times Magazine named him one of America's most influential thinkers. The World Affairs Council lists him as one of the nation's 500 leading authorities on international issues. Mr. D'Souza is the author of several books, including the latest, The Enemy at Home, The Cultural Left and Its Responsibility for 9/11. Good morning.
Nice to be on the show.
Yes. So why is the cultural left responsible for 9/11?
Well, there's a foreign policy dimension to this and a cultural dimension. Let's start with the foreign policy dimension. The radical Muslims have been around since the 1920s, but for a long time they were in the minority. They were on the outskirts of power. Then in 1979, they got their hands on a major state, which is Iran. And Khomeini was the inventor of modern Islamic radicalism. He was the first leader to call America the Great Satan. He was the first guy to call for a worldwide Muslim jihad and martyrdom against America. So how did we get Khomeini? The United States in the 70s was allied with the Shah of Iran. But when Jimmy Carter was elected in 76, his liberal advisors said to him, "You proclaim to be for human rights, and yet here we are allied with the Shah, who is a dictator. You can't do this. You should pull the Persian rug out from under him." And so America began to withdraw its support for the Shah. when the mullahs began to resist the Shah begged the Carter administration to help, and the Carter administration refused. And finally, Carter encouraged the Shah to abdicate, and in getting rid of the bad guy, we got the worst guy. Mm-hmm. So here was a case where, I think quite objectively, liberal foreign policy put radical Islam in a position where it went from having seminars and giving speeches in mosques to now controlling one of the four major states of the Middle East. That was the first step. In that sense, I think the rise of Khomeini, even today, Iran is a kind of model for what the Islamic radicals throughout the world want, a kind of theocratic state. I think the seeds of that were sown in 1979. So that was the first step.
Yeah, well, I thought your arguments were more so that it wasn't foreign policy so much as it was our liberal decadent culture.
Well, I'll get to that. Mm-hmm. But see, the thing is, I am saying that foreign policy is an important dimension. I'm simply saying that the motives that liberals attribute mm-hmm. in foreign policy are often wrong. For example, liberals will say, you know, America has had a colonial history in the Middle East, which we have not. Or it's all about Israel. And then I say, well, if that's true, why hasn't Al-Qaeda launched a single attack on Israel? Or the liberals say, America's policy has been so hostile to the Muslims, we've killed so many Muslims. And I say, wrong. America fought on the side of the Muslims to push the Soviets out of Afghanistan. America created a coalition of Muslim countries to push a secular dictator, Saddam Hussein, out of Kuwait. Even Clinton bombed in Bosnia and Kosovo to save mm-hmm. Muslim lives. So if anyone looks at American foreign policy on the balance, I don't think it has been consistently anti-Muslim. So I'm not denying the importance of foreign policy. I'm denying the usual reasons given to explain Muslim rage.
Yeah, then how do we explain why Al-Qaeda decided to topple the World Trade Center and strike the Pentagon, military and economic power?
Okay. The reason that they chose the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, they say themselves in their literature and the Bin Laden videos and so on, is not simply because the World Trade Center represented capitalism, but because it represented American capitalism. There was a very interesting discussion on one of the radical programs in which somebody said, "Hey, why don't you radical Muslims tackle Europe? Europe is more decadent than America. Europe is more secular. The European culture, in a way, is more pornographic and so on." And this Muslim sheikh said, "Well, that's because it is American culture and not European culture that is spreading into every nook and cranny of the world. Nobody wants to listen to Swedish jokes or French films. It is the power, the infectious power, one may say, of American humor, American ideas, American values, that's making its way particularly into the small precincts of the Muslim world." And so that's why Bin Laden, I think, has made America, if you will, what he calls the global head of the unbelievers.
Yeah. Let me welcome in Bill in Deerfield. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Well, okay. It sounds like your guest just doesn't like American culture.
Wait. That's not true. I'm an immigrant. I like American culture.
All right.
I'm giving an explanation for a foreign policy event.
Well, I'll give you a better explanation.
Okay.
Are we in agreement that it was Al-Qaeda?
Of course.
Okay. So some people aren't. Just to make sure that we're on the same page then. Osama bin Laden gave the exact reason in his manifesto. It had nothing to do. He never said anything about Western culture. He talked about the American military in the Holy Land, and he gave four things that America had to do if they wanted peace with Al-Qaeda. And they all involved getting the American military out of Saudi Arabia, and George Bush accommodated him. We are no longer in Saudi Arabia. So he said it. He wrote it. All you got to do is read it. It's right there. Has nothing to do with Western culture.
Okay, well, you didn't say what you were citing. I assume you're talking about his 1998 declaration, right?
Bill, are you still there? No, Bill's
right.
Not there.
Look, let me say this. Bin Laden in the 1990s, here's something interesting. Right after the Cold War, these radical Muslims went back to their own countries. Bin Laden went back to Saudi Arabia. Al-Zawahiri went back to Egypt. They were fighting to overthrow their local governments, what they called the near enemy. And they wanted to establish, as you say, Sharia law in their countries. And then they made a very important shift and decided, you know what, let's change and attack not the near enemy, but the far enemy, the United States. Al-Zawahiri, in his book, Knights Under the Prophet's Banner, says he made this decision because he realized the far enemy, America, is propping up the near enemy. What's keeping countries, dictators like Mubarak in Egypt in power, or Abdullah in Jordan, or the royal family in Saudi Arabia? It's America. But then you might think, wait a second, if the radical Muslims cannot overthrow their local governments, what makes you think that they can attack the United States, which is the world's superpower? Bin Laden says he came to the realization that America is outwardly tough, but inwardly weak and cowardly. And I think in the 1990s, we saw a series of test strikes launched against America. There was the Khobar Towers attack, the bombing of our embassies, the attack on the coal. And in every case, the Clinton administration did little or nothing. In fact, its responses confirmed American ineffectiveness and ineptitude. And Bin Laden says, by my own account, this emboldened us to conceive of a grander attack on American soil. Now, right after 9/11, Bin Laden issued his letter to America, dated 2002, in which he laid out the intellectual sort of basis for his critique of America. And in it, he does discuss foreign policy. It's about a third to a half of the address. He discusses U.S. troops in Mecca. He mentions the Palestinians. He talks about a couple of other things. But he also talks about gambling, fornication, adultery. He talks about America, in a sense, as the head of global atheism. He says America used to be Christian, now it is pagan, and even worse, it is imposing its paganism on the rest of the world, undermining Muslim belief, toppling the Muslim family, corrupting the innocence of Muslim children. This dimension of the radical Islamic critique is very important. It suffuses the works of people like Khomeini, Sayyid Qutb, Ali Shariati, Maulana Maududi, in other words, the thinkers of radical Islam who are shaping minds over there. So to simply pluck out one phrase of Bin Laden, the U.S. troops in Mecca, and go around as if that was his sole motive, I think is a very distorted understanding of Bin Laden and of radical Islam itself.
Our guest is Dinesh D'Souza. He is author of The Enemy at Home, The Cultural Left and Its Responsibility for 9/11. Dinesh D'Souza, named by the New York Times Magazine as one of America's most influential conservative thinkers. He's a fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, and he will be a guest speaker, part of the Distinguished Lectures Series on the UW-Madison campus tomorrow night. He's part of, it's at the Memorial Union Theater. Free tickets are available at the Memorial Union box office for the Distinguished lecture series. However, we don't know if any are still available. You can call the Union box office. That number is 262-2201, 262-2201. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, 24 minutes past 8 o'clock right now on this Monday, January the 29th, talking with Dinesh D'Souza, who is author of The Enemy at Home, The Cultural Left and Its Responsibility for 9/11. And Dan in Madison is with us next. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Good morning. I realize my perspective differs a little from your guests, but to me, when I hear the cultural left, I think of people who would rather send diplomats than send tanks. I think of people who wouldn't have installed the Shah, thus guaranteeing that you would have Ayatollahs that followed him. I think of people who are less likely to be rabidly evangelical to the point of being more Zionist than most Israelis. And I think of people who are more likely to negotiate than stomp over local values. And I think, honestly, the cultural right, for the most part, would be happy to see Sharia law and religious dictators as long as they were dictators that the cultural right felt they could do business with.
Okay, sir. We have some common ground here, but you're going off track for a minute. The Shah was a secular dictator, not a religious dictator. He was running against the sentiments of the Iranian people, who are generally quite devout. He had a program of rapid secularization. He closed down the Muslim schools. He made the veil illegal, and so on. Now, he was supported in America initially by the right and the left. The right supported him, as you say, because he was pro-American. He would do business with us. The left supported him because he was secular. So the problem is that this alienated the Muslim population. Now, when you say that you would like to find a way to, as an alternative to force and so on, I think that this is very good. But I don't know if you realize that while the left, the political left, the cultural left, in America and Europe, is accusing Bush of foreign policy imperialism in the Middle East and in Iraq. The left has its own program of cultural imperialism that it is very aggressively, although somewhat below the radar screen, promoting worldwide. For example, right now as we speak, there are organizations like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and so on, that are filing lawsuits in South America to force democratically elected countries that have admittedly restrictive abortion laws to overturn those laws. The reason is that abortion is declared to be an international human right, and so the high courts of these countries are told if you don't overturn these laws, you will be a pariah in the international community. Similarly, Planned Parenthood International is boasting on its websites and so on that it has clinics all over the world in which it is handing out condoms to teenage girls without the permission of their parents. Now, here in Europe and America, we say, okay, it's safe sex and all that. But most of the world outside of Europe and America is quite traditional. You go to China or India or Southeast Asia or to any Muslim country and start giving unmarried girls condoms, and you will have a riot on your hands. So what I'm saying is that why are we undermining and assaulting the traditional values of most of the world's people? This is being done in the name of a certain kind of liberal progressivism, but what many people in the West consider to be progressive, liberating, and so on, is from the point of view of traditional cultures, an assault on decency, on modesty, on virginity, and on morality.
Yeah.
And the radical Muslims exploit that.
Why, Dinesh D'Souza, did the radical Muslims wait until 2001 when George Bush had been elected and the right was in control for the first time in a long time, and all of these things you say the radical Muslims hated could have been, at least reduced under that administration?
Well, the strange thing is, two things. First of all, even the Bush administration, weirdly, at least initially, and I think in some ways even now, has always tried to appease domestic concerns, portray itself as a force of liberalism in the world. Even when the United States invaded Afghanistan after 9/11, both President Bush and Laura Bush essentially said, we did this to liberate the women. Now, this was actually not true. America invaded Afghanistan to shut down the Al-Qaeda training camp sponsored by the Taliban. But I think the reason Bush said that was he was trying to say, okay, well, maybe I'll get some liberals and feminists to come on board. But, of course, abroad, this message was read very differently, which is to say, what? You know, Bush thinks that he can invade a country because he doesn't like the patriarchal family structure that, frankly, exists in most of the world. This was seen as preposterous. So I think that, if we read the 9/11 report, we see that 9/11 was planned and conceived long before Bush came to office. I think one of the strange things about it was that between 1996 and 2000, when bin Laden moved from the Sudan to Afghanistan, the CIA analyst Michael Schur estimates that there were many chances for the United States to get bin Laden, to strike at bin Laden. But the Clinton administration took none of them, oddly enough. By the time Bush came to office in early 2001, bin Laden already had all the links of 9/11 in place, and he was already in deep hiding. At that point, I think there's a general consensus it was very difficult to find him and get him. But before that, he was preaching sermons in the local mosque. His wives were in the local market. He gave interviews to Peter Arnett of CNN, John Miller of ABC News, Abdel Bari Atwan, the Pakistani journalist. He was speaking to Al Jazeera. So apparently all these people could find him, but not the Clinton administration.
We are talking with Dinesh D'Souza, author of The Enemy at Home, The Cultural Left, and Its Responsibility for 9/11. And our next caller is Kurt in Waukesha. Hi, Kurt.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Please go ahead. We have kind of a bad connection, so be brief if you can,
okay,
please.
Okay, I'll be quick and precise. Your guest is very funny, though a little bit dangerous.
Don't name call. Please talk about an issue without name calling.
I will. The real reason for 9/11 is a religion, and it's not what the guest is espousing, which is the so-called degradation of the left of the United States. This point of view was originally put forward by Jerry Falwell soon after 9/11, and what this guest is trying to do is hide that same fundamentalist religious point of view in a lot of revisionist history. In fact, the religion that probably this guest adheres to is much more like the 14th and 15th century Islamist religion that that led to 9/11 to begin with. And I don't think it's any more fair to say something bad about this person's religion than this person alludes to when he talks about atheism as a moral underpinning for what's going on.
Yeah, we're losing you, Kurt, but we get your points. Dinesh D'Souza, are you saying the same thing Jerry Falwell was saying?
Well, first of all, you know, I'm an immigrant from India. My family is originally Hindu, converts to Catholicism. We have nothing to do with the kind of fundamentalism that Falwell represents. Second, you know, Falwell was making a different point. He said 9/11 is God's punishment on America. So he's resorting to a certain kind of theological reasoning, if you will, that I have nothing to do with. I'm simply asking a kind of clinical question. Why did the guys who did this do it? Now, this, I think 5 years after 9/11, we can intelligently discuss this question. I agree there are a range of views. I'm trying to open the debate. For example, right after 9/11 and since then, there has been this idea that this war is a clash of fundamentalisms, sort of two crazy groups of fundamentalists fighting each other. There are Islamic fundamentalists, there are Christian fundamentalists. Both are bad, and therefore the solution for the world is secularism. Make our society secular, make their society secular. I am saying that this very quote, solution is the root of the problem. When America goes abroad and tries to impose its secularism on the rest of the world, we violate the sensibilities of traditional Hindus, traditional Muslims, traditional Buddhists, and so on. This idea of separation of church and state is an American invention. Even the Europeans don't have it. England has an established church. Even secular France and Germany give money to religious schools. So we've taken something that is uniquely American, and oddly, the very liberals who normally condemn ethnocentrism, condemn imperialism, are here about championing this idea of forcing secularism down the throats of the rest of the world's people. Naturally, there is an emotional, intellectual, and religious revolt against it. So the caller is right. This is about religion. And essentially what the Bin Laden guys are saying to people is Islam is under attack. This is the rallying cry of Islamic radicalism. And if you think about it, why would an ordinary Muslim in the Somalia or the Sudan be willing to go to his death? Because the Palestinians don't have a state? I don't think so. But if you tell him, listen, your religion is under attack, your family is under attack, the values of your children are being corrupted, all by America, which is leading a global campaign to do it, then you say, oh, yeah, I think I better fight back against it. So my concern is not to persuade the radical Muslims, of course, but it is to drive a wedge between radical Islam and traditional Islam. The traditional Muslims are where the radical Muslims are getting their recruits, and I don't see how we can win the war on terror without separating these two camps.
So, Dinesh D'Souza, you think the cultural right in this country needs to defeat the cultural left?
Well, I think that the cultural right needs to recognize that there is a strange kind of coalition in this war. Now, by don't misunderstand me. I'm not implying any kind of conspiracy or anything. I'm just saying that if you followed the marches in Washington, for example, the demonstrations of this weekend, listen to the rhetoric, it's very clear that there's a whole bunch of people who want Bush to fail in Iraq. They want Bush to lose. Now, they don't want bin Laden to win. They don't like bin Laden. They recognize that the Islamic radicals are very illiberal. But in some ways, they don't like bin Laden, but they hate Bush more. And as their rhetoric seems to suggest, they see that bin Laden is a threat over there, but they find Bush to be a threat over here. It's almost as if bin Laden may want Sharia in Baghdad, but as the left sees it, Bush wants Sharia in Boston. And so Bush is, in a way, the near enemy, and the radical Muslims are the far enemy. And so I'm concerned that Bush is facing two enemies. I mean, an enemy abroad, and in some ways an enemy at home, a very determined political coalition that's trying to make sure that Bush fails in Iraq.
Yeah. Those protesters aren't so much saying they want Bush to lose as they want to withdraw U.S. troops from Iraq to keep them from dying.
True, but think about this. I mean, you know, this happened, we had this with Vietnam, and when when America withdrew in disgrace and humiliation in Vietnam, there was a bloodbath in Indochina, but it didn't affect our interest, frankly, all that much. Iraq is very different. The radical Muslims have controlled Iran now for a generation. They are very eager to get a second major state. They have already said that if they do, they will target Egypt and Saudi Arabia. So my point is that this is an area where our vital interests, admittedly our way of life, as long as we continue to be dependent on foreign oil, and our physical security is all involved. So I don't think we can afford to lose Iraq. And so this sort of reckless rhetoric, let's just pull out and see what happens. It couldn't be worse than it is already. It could get a lot worse.
Next we'll go to Michael in Madison. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Ms. Cardine. Mr. D'Souza, I've not heard such a cogent and factual presentation of the issue. It's astonishing. I had to check to see if I was actually on public radio.
Yeah, we never have any guests like this. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, your point, Mr. D'Souza, is well taken, that there is a religious ideology of the left, and they're very dogmatic about it, and they use the courts to try to impose it upon anybody. And when they argue, as one of the callers did, they argue backwards. Well, if we were there at that time, we would have done this or we would have done that, rather than, Sun Tzu said, to defeat your enemy, you must know the mind of your enemy. You've so studied those people and what they think and what they're determined to do that, unfortunately, in our country, as you've expounded about the State Department and their policies, would you talk more about the cultural ideology that you believe is driving those State Department decisions?
Well, let me say a couple things. You know, I focus on the left in this book, but on the other hand, I have a chapter that criticizes or questions some of the assumptions that the Bush administration has, which is to say this idea that the radical Muslims are simply against science or against capitalism or against modernity. Bush has said they hate us for our freedom, but if you look at the literature of radical Islam, you see that they're not condemning freedom. They're condemning the way in which we use our freedom and, in their view, impose it or impose our values on them. Now, in this business of the war and the State Department and Iraq, this is my concern, and that is that, as Sun Tzu, whom you mentioned, and Clausewitz and others have said, success in war is the product of force times will. All the force in the world is useless if you don't have the will to fight. And this is the secret weapon of the insurgents. They really don't have to win in Iraq. They don't have to beat the U.S. military. They just have to hang in there for the impatience of the American people to kick in, and for the left to convince the American people, listen, it's not worth one more American life. Let's get out. So I'm concerned that the war in Iraq is not being lost in Iraq, but is being lost in the American mind. It's being lost right here at home. It may end up being lost in the corridors of Congress. So that's the concern, that fundamentally this is as much about us as about them. The culture war domestically in this country is linked with the war on terror in a way that I don't think has been previously recognized.
Yeah. Thank you, Michael, for the call. Joe in La Crosse is with us now. Hi, Joe.
Hi, good morning. I just want to say, first of all, I've been a longtime fan, if you will, of yours, Mr. D'Souza, from National Review and many, many years ago. But my opinions over the last few years have shifted somewhat from where yours are. And I guess one of my concerns is that you, of all people, you're a bright guy. But in Buddhism, we have an expression that says when we're sitting in the thorns, we forget that we planted them. And that's absolutely where we are today in the Iraq situation, in the Iran situation, and in the Middle East. And by the way, just in deference to the last caller, I would suggest that if you want an amazingly cogent view of what's going on in the world today, particularly in the Middle East, I would take a look at a columnist called Spengler in the Asia Times and the A Times Online. The other thing is, if you'll recall, sir, Sun Tzu said that the highest victory was to be able to win without fighting. And we've avoided that. We've actually managed to turn away from that and get to the point where we have to fight and we have to go in and do some of the things that we're doing. When we went into Afghanistan, we went in with, in a sense, we went in with a clear-cut plan of where we were going and what we were going to do. We don't have that in Iraq, and that's one of the things that trouble the American people. I don't think there was a protest against what we were doing over there right after 9/11. We were responding to something that was clear-cut. I think the American people are tired of not having a really clear vision of what we're doing, and I think that's been the Bush administration's greatest weakness.
You know, there's very little that you've said so far I disagree with. It has been the Bush administration's greatest weakness. I'm trying to remedy that weakness in this book, to be honest. I think you'll find a lot in it that you agree with. You're absolutely right. We have planted some of those thorns. In retrospect, I think the Iraq invasion was a mistake. In retrospect, I would rather that America had focused, not invade, but focused on Iran, because Iran has been in the clutches of radical Islam and has been pursuing, apparently with more success, the weapons of mass destruction. But look, here's the point. No president ever got to make a decision in retrospect. Statesmen are in the moving current of events. You have to make decisions with the information available at the time. Bush made a tough call, I think in retrospect, the wrong call. But here we are in Iraq, and we have to figure out what to do. I think what America is trying to do in Iraq is actually something quite noble, which is that in the Middle East today, if you are an ordinary Muslim and you look around your part of the world, you see two types of regimes, two types of governments. You see Islamic tyranny of the kind that you have in Iran, and you see secular tyranny. Now, secular tyranny would be Assad in Syria or Mubarak in Egypt or Abdullah in Jordan. So this is a very depressing choice for the ordinary Muslim. Not the radical Muslim, but the ordinary guy. What do I choose between Islamic tyranny or do I have secular tyranny? And I think in Iraq, America is trying to have a third choice, which is Muslim democracy. Now, you know, Bush sometimes gets carried away. We want to have democracy everywhere. No, we don't want to have democracy everywhere. We're not the world's policemen, but we are trying to have democracy somewhere to give the traditional Muslims a third alternative. So I hope it succeeds. I realize history is against it and that it's very difficult. And it does involve fighting, not by our choice, but because we've got a very determined insurgency drawing from a minority group that wants to overthrow an elected government. So it's a fight over there. I don't see a way to avoid it at this point.
Our guest is Dinesh D'Souza, author of The Enemy at Home, The Cultural Left and Its Responsibility for 9/11. Mr. D'Souza will be in Madison tomorrow night for the UW-Madison Memorial Union's Distinguished Lecture Series. I'll give you more information on that in a moment. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. According to Kathleen Dunn's guest, coming up after 9 o'clock, an insurgency is a political problem that no array of sophisticated combat techniques can defeat. We'll talk more about that after 9 o'clock. We're talking with Dinesh D'Souza, who is author of the book, The Enemy at Home, The Cultural Left and Its Responsibility for 9/11. He is a fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He will be the next distinguished lecturer in the UW's Distinguished Lecture Series. This is at the UW Memorial Union tomorrow night at 7:30. To see if there are any free tickets still available, you can call the box office, 608-262-2201. Our next caller is April in Platteville. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm concerned about the direction of this discussion. In order to decrease America's risk of attack by religious radical extremists, if we follow the advice of your speaker, we would have to adopt a position of moral appeasement, and I'm afraid of where that would end. The example of teenagers being given condoms as being offensive, in order to appease people with those kinds of thoughts, we would be required to discriminate against homosexuals and possibly erode many of the improvements we have made to the treatment of people based on gender and sexual orientation. I can't support this position at all. And I think there are some moral standards that are worth dying for.
Okay, but I would think we would make, I'd make a distinction here between our own society and the world. We, as a self-governing nation, have a right to make rules for ourselves, right? We're in a social compact. We pass laws. We can have gay marriage if we want to, for example. But if you're saying that the United States has some kind of a moral or legal right, let's say, to impose gay marriage on the world, I think that this is sheer insanity. The United States has no such right. There is no such right ensconced in the UN Charter of Rights. The nations of the world came together when the United Nations was formed, and in a very spectacular agreement, were able to settle on a wide range of rights that were deemed to be universal. I agree, those rights should be defended, the right against extreme forms of wanton torture, the right of, there's certain rights of, there's the right of the, actually of people to form families, the right, for example, to be gainfully employed by consent and not by force. Slavery is outlawed and coercive employment. So there are some very specifically delineated rights, and people of different religious backgrounds or even no religion were able to agree this is the sort of, this is the list of rights that the world can agree on. Now, what we are seeing now is a new liberalism, which has a very different agenda than the old liberalism. And what it is trying to do is take these new rights, which are very controversial even here in America. Gay marriage can barely survive a referendum in any state. And take these rights, declare them to be universal, and then go to very traditional societies with very different sets of religious and moral codes and arm twist these societies into saying, listen, if you don't abide by these agendas, we will cut off your funding. In Turkey's case, if you don't liberalize laws on homosexuality, we will not let you into the European Union. So what I'm saying is when you go to traditional Muslims, most of whom believe in democracy, believe in the freedom of assembly, believe in the rights of the old liberalism, and try to force feed them the new liberalism, they become very vulnerable candidates for a bin Laden to say, look at this immoral West that is coming here to our part of the world with all its money and all its power and forcing its way of life on us. If we accept this way of life, it will undermine our religion, capsize our families, and corrupt our children. So, and strangely, the caller seems to think we have some sort of a universal mandate to fight and die for this, and I don't believe it's so.
One of our listeners, Jacob, emailed you this question, Mr. D'Souza. If liberals are the enemy at home in the U.S., then what should be the solution to deal with all of this? The title of your book must have a conclusion. Should we be called enemy combatants and put in jail? Should we be executed as traitors?
No. And I see the caller trying to save himself $26.95, which is all right. But look, no, my approaches to this are really quite mainstream and reasonable. I'm telling, for example, President Bush, I'm saying, look, the traditional Muslims look at America, and all they seem to see is blue America, right? The weird thing is if you go to Europe and you ask people in France and Germany, why don't you like America? All they seem to see is red America. Oh, it's because you've got the cowboy in the White House, you've got wacky religious fundamentalists speaking in tongues and so on. Then you go to the Islamic world and you find people who don't like America and they point to blue America. You've got a popular culture that's vulgar and trivial and debased and vulgar. You've got the family in a state of breakdown. You've got gays getting married and so on. Now, neither of these is really the full picture of America. So what I'm saying to Bush is why don't you show the traditional world the other America, the America, frankly, that you rarely see on the movies or in television. When I turn on my television, television screen. I very rarely see anybody ever go to church. If I see two people having sex, they're usually not married, or at least not to each other. So there is another America that's traditional, people who support their families and live by traditional values. I think that if the Muslim world saw that America, it would be much less likely to believe the Bin Laden fable that we are all a bunch of immoral atheists.
We will move on to Greg in Milwaukee. Hello, Greg.
Yes, for you to ignore the colonialism of Kermit Roosevelt installing, overthrowing Mossadegh in the early 50s, and the Bin Laden complaints about American presence in the Holy Land, and emphasize the cultural liberalism, when this cultural liberalism is an ally against these people and not an enemy, which you choose to label them, is the same kind of intellectual dishonesty that Pat Buchanan used when he started this culture war in the United States, and along the same lines as Ann Coulter.
All right, but look, let's look at this a little more carefully. Why is Bin Laden against American troops in Saudi Arabia? Have you ever thought about that? Do you think that he's against the uniforms? The U.S. base in Saudi Arabia is 500 miles away from Mecca and Medina. It is actually in the Arabian desert and leaves no footprint on Saudi society. Why is Bin Laden so upset about it? He says very clearly, the reason I oppose America's military is because America's military is part of a transmission belt for American values. So there is, in their mind, an inextricable link between our foreign policy and our way of life. We are carrying, if you will, through our business and through our trade and through our oil deals and through our support for secular dictators and through our troops a set of American values that they claim is corrupting. Second of all, you bring up the old Mossadegh story, which I think I'm very happy to be able to clarify. First of all, Mossadegh was elected by nobody. He was not an elected leader of Iran. He was appointed by the Majlis, the parliament, and confirmed by the Shah, who was already in power. Upon seizing power, Mossadegh immediately became a dictator, suspended civil liberties, got into a political fight with the Shah, dissolved the parliament, and was essentially trying to establish himself as a kind of Saddam Hussein, a kind of despot. There was an organized movement within Iran led by the radical Muslims to overthrow Mossadegh for the obvious reason that Mossadegh was a socialist. The Ayatollah Khomeini was very active in the movement to overthrow Mossadegh, and when the CIA cooperated in overthrowing Mossadegh and restoring the Shah, the Ayatollah Khomeini preached two sermons in which he praised the CIA for getting rid of Mossadegh. I cite this all in my book, and it dispels this sort of leftist myth that somehow the United States came in, overthrew this wonderfully elected man, and the seeds of discontent were sowed since the 50s, and that's why the radical Muslims don't like us. The real story is quite different.
Thanks to Greg. Rod in Weyerhaeuser is with us now. Hello.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. When your guest referred to the protesters, that he had a hint that they were the far left, that no matter what, they just want Bush to fail. I have a tendency to agree with him to some extent, the far left. But on the other token, the far, far right, if there was a Democrat in office, I believe they would want him to fail. I just feel that. And I guess, is there really, truly a middle-of-the-road man out there, person out there?
Well, I think your question is actually very good, and it reflects something that is, I think, distressing in our politics, which is the sort of politics of pathological personal hatred. We did see it with the right and Clinton in the 1990s, sort of this idea that, that nothing the man could do was right. This is not my view. I think actually Clinton was a pretty good president. I don't admire him as a man, but I think that he was a pretty good president. But there were many people on the right who just couldn't stand the guy. And I think on the left you see this now. There's a sort of pathological hatred toward Bush. In my book, I point to something called the indignation gap, which is if you listen to speeches of some of these left-wingers, even some of the left-wing leadership, elected leadership, you'll find that when they talk about bin Laden, for example, or al-Zawahiri, they obviously will condemn them, but in perfunctory terms. You know, granted, bin Laden is an evil man. Granted, al-Zawahiri is not a nice guy. Granted, Saddam was not a good man, and so on. But when they turn to Bush, the gloves really come off, and a certain kind of hatred comes through. Bush is destroying the Constitution. Bush is ruining the American way of life. He's the worst president ever, and so on. You get the idea that Bush is their real enemy. Bush is the one who really threatens their liberal values here at home, and in some ways they're more eager to run Bush and the Republicans out of town than they are to defeat the Islamic radicals abroad.
Yeah. Is Nebraska Republican Senator Chuck Hagel an enemy at home because he disagrees with the president about the war in Iraq?
No, and I'm not saying, and nowhere in the book do I say that all disagreement, mm-hmm. I mean, I disagree with Bush mm-hmm. on the war in Iraq. I've said it was a mistake. I think there have been all kinds of blunders of strategy and so on. But look, here's the difference. If we look at earlier wars like World War II, in World War II there was a kind of consensus in America that despite all the blunders, and there were huge blunders, that this war will not end unless American troops are in Berlin. We debate the way of how to get there. What's changed now is not that there's a debate or there's mistakes, but what's changed is that moral consensus on the indispensability of victory. Again, this is not Vietnam. Vietnam was part of some domino theory. That was a war that in some ways we could afford to lose. I think here the stakes are much higher. So some of the people who say, I'm doing this for the military and so on, yes, you are, but you're also playing with fire, and you have to ask yourself, aren't you making the mistake of Iran all over again? There, in trying to get rid of the bad guy, the Shah, we got the worst guy, Khomeini. And now, again in Iraq, in trying to get rid of a bad situation, admittedly a bad situation, we are risking a far worse situation.
Let me get in one more caller. Robert in Madison. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. A couple of comments.
We're very short on time. Give us your primary comment, please.
My primary comment is I believe the speaker has, your guest has an intellectual dilemma. On the one hand, imposing any kind of American values, right, middle of the road, or left, on any other population in the world is a bad thing and naive on our part. The second thing is leaving Iraq. If we win in Iraq, well, then we're going to have more of the same. If we leave Iraq, the guest seems to say that no good things can happen, that good Sunnis and good Shiites can't get together and solve their problems and cut themselves off from the global economy.
Yeah, we only have a minute, not even a minute, to Dinesh D'Souza.
Yeah, I think that, the problem is that the Sunni were ruling the country through the Ba'athists for the past 25 years. Now the Shia are in power courtesy of democracy. This is a bitter war of power for the Sunnis to get back in power, and they're helped in this by the radical Muslims. So I think it's very unlikely, if the United States, together with the elected government, has its hands full in dealing with the insurgency, it's fairly predictable that if America pulls out, the elected government will come under interminable pressure from the insurgents to collapse. So I fear that we're going to get a bad outcome, either Shia radicalism or Sunni radicalism will reign in Iraq. Democracy will be killed off in that region for a generation, and America will be not only, and Americans will be a lot less safe.
Well, unfortunately, on that note, we're out of time. Thanks very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Dinesh D'Souza, author of The Enemy at Home, The Cultural Left and Its Responsibility for 9/11. We'll be in Madison for the Distinguished Lectures Series tomorrow night, 7:30, Memorial Union. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.